we have two of the three authors of this paper.
The empty chair,
that's right. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves. And I'm also then going to screen my... I gave them a list of questions that I would be asking them, but I have the list of the gotcha questions here that they haven't seen. And I'll alternate between those two witnesses. So Neil, why don't you introduce yourself?
So why don't I get my introduction? You just be as you may be able to tell, I'm coming from Germany, studying modern physics. And at that point, I decided that I wanted to do something that was at more instant gratification in the computer science kind of environment. And specifically, the University of Michigan, because it was supposed to come there, it actually allowed me to drive over to the border to winter, sort of break into the computer lab, actually, Peter was from the dean of the university at some point, which was fantastic, and write OpenSSL crypto code.
This is my big competitive advantage, is that my office is in Canada.
Let me get the first question. What's your name again?
You can pronounce it
Neil. And who's this guy?
Okay.
Peter.
Who's very booming? Did you booming? You want to introduce yourself? When Niels came to the University of Michigan, we learned something new about graduate school. Niels didn't really hang with the department, but he did have to take courses he took nine courses, which is, I think, typical for a grad student. He got 16 pluses in his nine courses, David. While he was a doctoral student, he was working on his dissertation, but in parallel, he produced open source, he produced Rhythm, his work covered separation systems, which was a paper published in the same section as the physicality of persistent calls. Around the voice over IP, back in the business with Honeycomb work. None of that was in the dissertation.
I'm at Google and manage all the security and privacy engineering teams, which sort of quite a broad spectrum, everything from the lowest level, production and network security all the way up to applications.
I'm a huge fan of it. It's called Preventing Privilege Escalation. And basically, my sort of high-level summary is it describes a new concept, or at least an architectural approach that we really hadn't been thinking about before. That was an alternative to the concept that we was what was the orthodoxy for how we build secure implementations, that they called privilege separation. And they did this in the context of essentially fixing a bug in a widely used piece of software called SSH. This 13-year-old paper, is still relevant today, even though the version of SSH with the bug in it is hopefully long gone. So I'd like to ask either or both of you, in 90 minutes or less, to give a brief summary of how you would describe the contribution of this paper then versus now.
First of all, none of this work in me was the bottom of frustration was sort of this fact that when we needed to have program that to what's supposedly very security contracts, such as the OpenBSD developers, they are incapable of producing code that doesn't have security vulnerability. And you might want to say, oh, that's, you know, scripts are tight, but now they say so much, and then you have these problems that are going to go away. In fact, that's often not all that practical, even though these days, maybe with Go, you know, as a new language, but actually becoming more feasible. But then you have to look at the fact that, you know, we know that our code is running. What are the kind of things that we can do to, you know, render the impact of these marks less severe? And there are things like this. I mean, if you try to do, you know, follow the location of your code, then when we were talking about that in between nodes, you can try to contain what the code that needs to be on the outside. You know, see that Chrome has potentially done that as their model. But what I was looking at was essentially a monolithic piece of code that really had many different facets to it. And each of these facets really intelligently required, you know, different kinds of privileges. And at that point, I was thinking, well, you know, what is it that we can actually do to break these pieces apart and, you know, give them the privileges that they need in sort of a generic Unix operating system that doesn't have primitives of that. And then when we looked at OpenSSH, so we sort of very quickly decomposed it into multiple phases. You know, one was the phase in which the program, you know, is not authenticated user, you know, it's actually of zero privilege. But it turned out that, you know, many of the bugs were actually in that code path. So, you know, there were bugs in, you know, Devlet, there were bugs in, you know, memory management, there were bugs with, you know, one of the interface problems. All of those led to root privileges in OpenSSH because it was running a few. And so I think the insights I had at that point is really great. Use case apart. We can have a very small privileged piece of code that essentially implements a state machine, and the state machine keeps track of, you know, what is it that this code should be able to do at the moment. And then, you know, on request, essentially sort of download the privileges that are being needed. And, you know, one of the nice things about Linux is that everything essentially is a file descriptor, and there are two great ways that you can find the scriptors of capabilities. And that is, you know, one of the things that we make use of for the OpenSSH for. I think the other interesting technical piece was at some point you have to do a state function, right? You have an unauthenticated piece where sort of the other end just proves to you that they should have the authority of the user on the system. And then you essentially have to transition to a piece of code that carries all of the privileges of that user. And that is also a primitive that is not available in most Linux operating systems. You cannot take an unprivileged process and rebrand it into a different user identity. And so within OpenSSH, we put all of that together, but essentially ended up with a system reasonably close, approximated, you know, the right privileges at the right point in time. And it turned out shortly after we had implemented that, we were being made aware of another root installation bug in OpenSSH, and we were under embargo not to disclose it. It was a weird setup at that time. So essentially what we could do is we could tell everybody, please deploy privilege separation because that's going to protect you. And I think that is my 5 minutes summary.
I absolutely said 90
minutes. It's less than 90 minutes.
Up to 90 minutes. Okay. That means I have to ask another question. How would you know, if so I have a copy of this paper in my classes, in spite of the fact that it is, you know, describing the specific application that you described, you know, that particular set of bugs is long fixed. What do you think the enduring contribution is? I mean, one of the things that I found interesting, for example, about reading old papers that are enduring is very similar to looking at old photographs that are enduring. Right? Often what you thought the subject was at the time turns out not to be what's interesting. And what do you think is the interesting with the benefit of 13 years of hindsight? What do you think the interesting contribution here is?
You know, as I mentioned when I was sort of talking about the work at the beginning, is that one of the problems that the student has not solved is how to teach developers to write CPU code. And I think that is still something that is true today. I mean, I sort of imagine, maybe Google, maybe other companies, where you have a checklist of 100 items that says, you know, these are all the things you need to consider for this kind of line of code to write to make sure that your code will not have negative security or privacy implications. And that is not really a scalable model. So, you know, one of the things that within Google we have invested in is sort of give developers, you know, infrastructure framework that takes care of a lot of the security problems that may arise when you write a web application. So, you know, all the serving template decisions and so on, right? Where you do not have to worry about the issues of input. In what context do I have to take it now so that, you know, cross-site scripting doesn't happen? And in some sense, I think it's privilege separation work. You can consider it as a kind of framework where, you know, one of the things we have to do, and I wish, you know, sort of more automated, I think John Song did a little bit of work on that. If you can sort of conceptualize your code into, you know, the privilege that it needs, that will sort of get you to a place where, you know, even programming errors in these pieces of the code will not going to be able to go beyond the privileges that are being granted. I mean, that said, you know, depending on the privileges, you can still do a lot of damage, but at least you can have damage to those. And I think that is, you know, the browsers have certainly adopted this model, you know, like mentioning Chrome, where everything is being separated by properties, and so there are other similar examples there.
Also, what was the bigger factor is that it describes a familiar pattern that is recognizable as a way of operating in real world security. And that's it, you know, forward attribution. And that's why network teams generally are written in this way.
Yeah, so that actually partly answered kind of one of the next questions, which is what would you say is the best example of that that this work has implemented? You mentioned the entire Chrome architecture has pieces of this. Peter, you mentioned networking generally. Is that what, you know, where you say the influence is, or is it kind of? But that's also an example where least privilege doesn't help, because the least privilege would be enormous, right? And networking and things.
Right. And this gives you a way to apply pushing application so that you can apply least privilege to that in meaningful ways that are different.
So if you know, one of us had a time machine and could go back 13 years ago and tell you, by the way, the paper's going to win our contest on the award. would it have been surprising to you that that of all of the papers published over that in that general time period, this is the one we selected as really an enduring contribution? Do you see this as groundbreaking work for at the time?
Last time I read that paper was last night. I read that paper 15 years ago.
I read it every night too.
Yeah, probably the name of that paper.
And they don't know the person. You told me your notes earlier, and there was one word that really jumped out at me, which is so what would you
I'd say the paper is not particularly well written. It was kind of a shift in experimental
engineering group or a technical group kind of mode of communicating and taking off the drive, just, you know, help us try to check it out, you know, maybe it's too loud.
As I was reading it, it did seem to be written by a very German grad student. In very short sentences, they were not really connected with each other.
So, other than the sort of editorial things like that, do you think you'd write this paper the same way today, or would you emphasize different things? Some of the editorial things that make you say, oh, do you think that paper with this set of contributions? So, I mean, how do you mention the
collection?
Yeah.
Who with everything that you're mentioning, right?
So this was really the right home for this work because of the implementation as well as
heard about the concept.
Uh-huh.
It was definitely different.
Uh-huh. So So how did this come about? Did you say, I want to come up with a new architectural, practical architectural model for separating out privilege because least privilege isn't good enough? I think it's not even a replicate for
you. Said before that, you know, that you're talking about new state of mind here. I think he was really drawn by a series of projects that opened up the system. Actually, when it happened, he threw himself into doing distributed government that didn't see how quickly the passwords were was being adapted. And I think that's what spawned the idea, the frustration that no matter how hard you work at it, you're going to get facts. And so you don't know how to really write correct software or secure software, and correct bugs are often just given security problems. I think that was what really was thinking about. Don't you think, Neil?
Sounds about right.
Well,
thank you, Peter. So, I mean, this is sort of backward from the model that was supposed to happen, right? Here's what I'm trying to do.
It's kind of exciting to come to this sort of research, which, you know, engineering is often not like that. I mean, we're more into the consciousness of our own, but better understand the world that we live in. I mean, computer science is a natural thing. We didn't start out that way. The biggest guy kind of
I want to talk a little bit about the publishing side of this. What were the reviewers' reactions to this? You know, already they didn't say you're the best paper. You can look at the members of that program and decide them. you don't read your things?
It's third miserable.
Republican.
So we have a
the microphone, I know that anything you've seen here, I think, is was influenced by this or think come out of the influence by this in some way. So I want to open it up to folks. I see some people lining up the microphone.
So, Niels, you mentioned some of the things that Google's doing with, like, automatic bug detection and so on. And so I wanted to ask both of you, what do you think of the follow-on research that other teams have done? And do you think there's maybe a little missed opportunity in terms of things like perhaps automatically detecting places where privilege separation might be appropriate?
I believe there has been follow-on work that is essentially that, right? I'm okay, it seems very leaving off the bridge within your code, and that may have to be done with the equipment that I don't remember.
I'd like to take about 60 seconds to review the history of logging in remotely, because this was a really important part, and I think this is really the biggest contribution of it. Originally, the telnet was really stuck to the passwords room here to be stiffed in the background. There was our login, you could do IP spoofing. And we all knew by the crypto wars of the mid-90s that we needed a solution like SSH. Matt and Steve Gellman came up with something called FTEL, which they had me play with, but they said it's not good enough to release. And then SSH came along, and suddenly we could log in with some plausible amount of security. Of course, we had protocol 1 that was broken. We got protocol 2, there were bugs in it. And when I saw this paper, I mean, the idea of privilege separation wasn't new. This was really applied to a really, really important piece of software. When I run a machine, the only network service is usually SSH, which means if it's broken, I'm screwed. And usually it's broken when I'm in Australia or someplace. And so this was really an important part of it. If you go online and look up SSH bugs now, you'll find out something was running in January. Someone put in some new debugging service which had holes in it, no surprise. I don't know if it was the privilege preparation stuff. But I think the really important stuff was making SSH more secure, which I thought was what Neil was really aiming for in the first place. We really needed it, and it's better. I know they use the filters of some of their secret network as another layer of safety.
I guess I'll follow this one by the last question where it seems like this is way better, and it's now 13 years later, but it's still not done. Well, this approach design has not been adopted for a lot of systems that seem like they should be designed this way and built this way. And so I'm like, if you would agree with that assessment and if you can comment on that, either technical or cultural, or what are the reasons why people are still building systems that don't adopt this kind of design the right way?
That is a very good question. And you're right.
Android
has actually adopted some of this, right? If you sort of look at the application model, that is specifically going that way, right? Each application has its own UID. You know, privileges are granted by the service that essentially goes, you know, negotiate them. So I think that is, you know, going in the way I think we're really struggling with the way in which we are developing our software. Right? Where oftentimes the security properties are baked into the code, where it might be much nicer if you could describe them externally and have a way of sort of systematically validating them. But I just don't think we'll be able to figure out how to do this actually in a practical fashion. But I mean, you run into this in all kinds of situations, right? Even if you're looking at, how do you authorize practices, right? There are oftentimes, the authorization module is written in your code, whereas, if you have it externally, you could reason about the previous systems in a proper way.
So it's interesting that security and probably other architectural advances sometimes take surprisingly long to make their way into practice. And maybe privilege separation is in that category. And I think another example, high-tech languages, right? We've had high-tech languages for over 2 decades, and we still have enormous amounts of crack written in C. Right? The underlying problem that privilege separation helps with is still with us in spite of other tools being available that would reduce that problem significantly.
I don't think insecure software is going away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but, you know, there's also a textual approach to that. Security, or at least contain
privilege. If there were only one way to extract privilege in the world of computers, then probably we could have that kind of impact. But the reality is, every system has every phone with no privilege, and it's a slow process. So, it takes everything.
Robert Astrom, University of Washington. I'd like to bring up an analog to the case of Unix daemons that have root and also non-root. My analog is NFS and root squash or not root squash. We found a few cases where we like to use not root squash. So in other words, root on an NFS client can become root on anything. And see all of the files of anyone on the NFS server. Is there a way to use the concepts of the paper to make me feel safer about that?
That's the paper here.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. That covers that. That's a good point. It would be accurate to the existing requirements more than anything else.
The problem was being able to leverage the main boot to serve a
loop. Other UID. I think that's what loop squash is.
Right.
That means that loop squash. And then, everywhere, throughout the process. And then you can have that plan. Much richer notion of the benefits. Probably kind of have to use the whole thing. Before that, kind of could have
Hi, Julian, Institute of Magic. I have a question. You mentioned about Google has the way to block attack and making sure security code is fit. I know that either company takes a small company has started to have better practice in enforcing code, because of software code. But now, today, compared to 25 years ago, there are even more companies with all kinds of software development, IoT devices everywhere. Financial incentives, how it takes to prevent all the companies, or most of the companies, to do the thing that Google does. Any thoughts on what the roadblock, how is it accountability that you can have a lot of companies, small and big and medium, to really, and all across, not the security company, not the software company, all doing what it's supposed to do. The same question is applied to the team. What's your thoughts on how can we educate or influence the threat to actually bring this practice much easier, widespread into a lot of places, not just big companies can afford that and have everything to do.
I'm just not so great about this. I mean, I've been working in computer science research for 30 years. Situation gets worse every year. The problem that we talked about solving 30 years ago or even the next 10 years are worse problems for that. So,
I think sort of the discipline you're problem with that, right? That we think that we end up doing for some reason tends to lead to more complexity. We do not know how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because now the complexity is human nature. It's just.
Stefan mentioned the Higma conference earlier this year, and Rob Goyce
the director of the NSA's Head of Success Operations, looking at offer and talk with the company on how to prevent his team from breaking into your system. And one of the insights was that we understand your network better than you do yourself. If you have a bot on your network, you know, you may have an idea of what we think it does for you. We know everything it does for you. And I think there is, you know, we have not solved that, right? If you look at your network, you know, you probably don't know all of the pieces of equipment that are on there. You not understand how to interact with each other. And sometimes you actually get a better handle on that, just because it seems impossible that we can really make strong statements about this area.
I had a different question, but I want to follow up on what you just were talking about. When I asked the question of the keynote speaker, I was trying to get her to respond to the notion of providing frameworks for programming called Visual Studio that would help people write secure software rather than encouraging the programmer to say C++. Which is, it's not even good, okay? And at Google, I think what I heard you say, Neil, is that you actually provide tools to Google programmers to encourage them to write secure software, like, say, Protobot, right?
I think what I was trying to say is that we believe that we will be solving the problem of security bugs in software by giving developers the records of 100 things that they have to write for every single line of code they write. We are going to fail. Instead, what we want to provide to our developers is infrastructure and framework that allows them to write the code that they want, right? I mean, they are really incentivized to write features. And the security and privacy or other properties that you care about are taken care of by the framework without me requiring, you know, for every single line of code, somebody to make the security assessment.
Right, yeah, you can't expect people to be testing 100 things for every line of code when they have more
usability, right, for your program. You have to provide APIs that they won't make mistakes.
Right, and it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. So, my original question before thinking about building better paper handlers is where we don't see privilege separation today, and I've been hammering on this for a long time, is in the kernel. And this is the most rich source of the highest level of escalation you can get, and it's also the largest program that people are running on the systems. Do you think there's any possibility we'll ever see privilege separation in operating systems?
And not the things that are actually very popular, there's one running in every iPhone in the room.
But those microphones are larger than what we used to call kernel.
That's like a little microphone, right? It's running in every iPhone in the room.
True, that's the L4. There's a guy who was here yesterday, Zonenberg, and he's presenting a paper at Chestnut next week on something he calls the anti-kernel.
He calls what?
The anti-kernel. And it's his PhD dissertation in Rensselaer in 2015. And he finally found a venue that published it. And partly because it's a hardware model. So, essentially, there is no root. There's no ring zero. It's more of an exo-kernel model of an operating system. So I think it might have some legs, and I thought I'd mention it. It is the ultimate privilege separation.
I think Michael Fritz actually on top of that. I mean, in the American effort, it's always a privilege user because they're a privilege instructor. Someone has to be able to do that.
Okay, thanks.
So, I have a couple of sort of last questions. One of the things that was mentioned on the list of questions is about work-life balance. And you guys are successful researchers, and you know, there's much more evidence in the fact that we didn't need a time award than that. But you know, you are examples of people who've managed to make enduring contributions. And Peter, I know that one of your enduring contributions was when we gave the claim the word for, which is mentorship of people like Niels.
and sometimes, you know, energizes me again for work. And that just how those two things, you know, fit together in my mind.
And you've got a lot of collection of stories now.
Yeah, there's lots of days that I don't know what to do with it.
Okay. So everyone should be nice to me. First of all, thanks to both of you for coming and for sharing. I think that we made a great decision, if I do say so myself as a member of the committee, in recognizing one of our examples of an enduring contribution. So with that, let's thank our honorees and. And you can come back in another 13 years and see what they've done since.